President Trump has now halted all military aid to Ukraine, believe it or not, freezing arms shipments and ending American-funded weapons purchases. The White House cites a push for peace talks with Russia, drawing sharp criticism from Kiev and NATO allies. This move signals a major shift in American policy and leaves Ukraine to fend for itself as tensions with Moscow clearly escalate. Joining us now, Dr. Richard Behnken. He's a commentator and journalist. Thanks, Dr. Behnken, very much for being with us. Now, one way or the other, without American arms supply, the war essentially is over for Ukraine in a finite period of time, right? Given the fact that Europe doesn't have the industrial base to support Ukraine's war effort in quite the manner in which America does.
First of all, thank you for having me on, sir. I really appreciate that. I would look at this in a broader context. Military conflicts end in one of two ways. Either one side militarily defeats the other and imposes the terms of the surrender, or it's a negotiated surrender. I think, I don't know who in any part of the world would really think that Ukraine can militarily defeat Russia. We know that that's not going to happen. So we've got two other things. Either Russia defeats Ukraine or there's a negotiated settlement. Clearly, it's the latter that we're headed for. And so one way or another, yes, it is over. But I think it's going to be over anyway. If U.S. taxpayers had to keep ponying up the billions of dollars and the hundreds of thousands of deaths and the tremendous destruction continued, I don't think Ukraine would get a better deal than it would get if it negotiates right now.
Dr. Behnken, do you feel that all this talk about, you know, getting boots on the ground, whether it's British soldiers or French soldiers, is essentially unrealistic?
Well, I mean, that's really up to the Europeans. So far, the Europeans haven't really shown much interest in actually doing that sort of thing. However, they have a ton. More importantly, again, I think let's look at how do you end this thing creatively, because there are a lot of geopolitical issues that are involved, including the breaking up the alliance between Russia and the other authoritarian states. So I think you got to look at it creatively. And the whole idea of that mineral deal was that, number one, it would tie Ukrainian and U.S. interests together in a very concrete way, number one. Number two, there would have to be Americans there on the ground, not necessarily military, not people who are funded by the U.S. taxpayers, by the way, but there would be Americans there, and that in itself would be an enormous deterrent to anyone who would want to invade or bomb Ukraine with American assets sitting there, vulnerable to their actions.
All right, Dr. Richard Behnken, thank you very much, sir, for being with us, sharing your views on what is a huge crisis. Which way forward, we don't really know. I'm joined by Tom Tugendhat, MP of the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom. Thank you, sir, very much for being with us. With America deciding to stop the arms supply to Ukraine, the onus is really on countries like yours, the United Kingdom and your European partners. Do you believe that you have the industrial base to keep supporting Ukraine indefinitely for the moment?
It's not just actually up to us, it's up to Ukraine. I mean, one of the things that's changed in the last 3 years is the way in which this conflict has been fought. You've been seeing various different battles going on, and you've seen online evidence of drone footage and the changing way in which these battles have been conducted. One of the things that happened only a few weeks ago, just over a month ago, was an entire combat arm was destroyed. A Russian combat arm was destroyed by 100 bits of Ukrainian kit. Now, the command and control and the people fighting that Ukrainian kit were 300 miles away in Kiev. It was all done by drone. So we're already seeing a big change, and the Ukrainians are building something like 50 or 100,000 drones a month, and we're seeing a complete change in the way in which they're able to defend themselves. So I think the possibility of a very, very long and ugly stalemate is growing, and that, I think, leaves nobody pleased. That leaves everybody concerned. That said, if you were looking for European support, Rheinmetall in Germany, or indeed The various different capabilities from Babcock and Thales in the United Kingdom are very capable of supplying the weapons that anybody would need.
Isn't the larger concern the fact that the number of Ukrainian soldiers available is sharply declining? The average age of Ukrainian soldiers has gone up tremendously because they simply don't have the manpower at this stage to indefinitely sustain a war. And as every month passes, Russia makes small creeping gains. And Ukraine's perhaps biggest problem is that lack of manpower. They cannot sustain this for a very long period of time. That's not going to change, no matter how much assistance Europe comes in with. Therefore, is it not wise at this stage to push for peace, even though, you know, it may not be a popular choice?
Look, let me just be clear straight out. Of course, I want peace in Ukraine.
Sure,
and
sure.
President Putin can have peace tomorrow by simply withdrawing. He's occupied, as you know, Luhansk and Donetsk. And if you want peace tomorrow, withdraw your Russian troops and you get peace. What people are arguing for is capitulation. That's a slightly different thing. Now, India would never tolerate it and certainly didn't tolerate it when countries to the north of you claimed parts of Indian territory. You quite rightly resisted, and your armed forces and your army in particular was heroic in defending Indian territory. But what we're seeing in Ukraine is something that is worth highlighting, which is that they did not begin conscription at the age of 18 and then move the age upwards, as is traditional. In fact, they did the reverse. They started conscription at the age of 40 and 35, and they moved it down. So a lot of the estimates that you're seeing about conscripted numbers and service numbers in Ukraine, I'm afraid they're simply false, because they're looking at the wrong end of the telescope. What we're also seeing, however, is clearly Russia is struggling, and there is no other way of putting it. There is nobody who invites North Korean troops into their territory to fight their battles for them who isn't struggling. The reality is Putin has now got to the point where he's either going to have to conscript people in St. Petersburg and Moscow, in which case he's going to have to face down those elites who have sustained him so far, or he himself is running out of people. We estimate that Russia has lost between 700,000 and 800,000 soldiers killed and wounded. That is a huge number, many times the number that was lost in Afghanistan.
But that number we don't have for Ukraine, do we? And that's part of the problem.
Well, we do have estimates for Ukraine, and they are less than 10% of that, much less than 10%, maybe even only
5%. Is that realistic? A lot of people suggest that those numbers are seriously low. I mean, they aren't a fraction of what the actual death toll is.
Sorry, there's no question. I mean, look, as a former military officer myself, I can tell you, you just have to look at the way in which the Russians and North Koreans are fighting on one side and the Ukrainians on the other. The Russians are sending out men in lines to be murdered, quite simply, and they're putting machine guns behind them so that if they retreat or if they fall back, they'll be killed by their own side. It's much more a recollection of Stalingrad than it is of any of the conflicts that the Indian Army or the British Army would be involved in. On the other side, you've got the Ukrainians who are digging in, who are protecting, and so, unsurprisingly, you're seeing a much greater loss in the attacking side than the defending. And in the 3 years, well, look at the reality. Russia's hold of Ukraine has gone from 19.6% at the beginning of this in February 2022 to 19.2% 3 years later, and with 800,000 dead. Anybody who claims Russia is winning is simply, I'm afraid, not looking at the facts. Russia is draining its young men. It is now draining North Korea's young men. It is destroying its economy. And now it's hoping to find a way out.
You know, there's some breaking news coming in on this very topic as we speak. We've got the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, saying that he regrets the Oval Office spat. He says it's time to make things right. These are his words. He says that future talks must be constructive, that he's ready to negotiate a peace deal as soon as possible, and that he values American U.S. aid in the war effort. And he's proposed a phased truce, right? And he's ready to sign a minerals deal. Now, that minerals deal, sir, was always, a low-hanging fruit. There wasn't any serious objection anywhere. But if he's proposing a phased truce, would you suggest that that is a way forward and reflects, a changing reality, at least in his mind?
Careful about speaking on behalf of other foreign leaders. The reality is President Zelensky has the mandate of the Ukrainian people, and I don't. It's up to him to decide what is the right fight for the Ukrainian people, and up to him to determine how he achieves that. But look, I think I agree with you that the minerals deal was low-hanging fruit, and I hope very much that a phased truce will establish the lines on which peace can be achieved. But we all know that peace could be achieved tomorrow, immediately, if President Putin withdrew his occupying forces from Ukraine. Now, if he's not going to choose to do that directly, then we need to recognize that we who are members of the United Nations, India, the United Kingdom, and everybody else, needs to stand with the country that has been the victim of this aggression. And if they decide, if their president decides that they are willing to accept a truce on different lines than the current borders or in a different way, then that's up to them, and we will stand with them.
Is it almost inevitable that the territory that Russia has captured in Luhansk and Donetsk, and certainly the Crimea, which it captured in 2014, would essentially remain that way? And the, you know, any truce or realistic truce, one which Putin would likely agree, would essentially mean that the contact line would be where it is right now, that they wouldn't move west any further, and that's something Ukraine would need to accept. Do you believe that Europe would accept that, and do you believe Ukraine would accept that?
Well, look, it's very difficult to say, because every time anybody's come to a deal with Putin, he's changed the terms. Don't forget, Russia guaranteed the current borders of Ukraine in 1994 in the Minsk Agreement, absolutely guaranteed it. Putin repeated that guarantee in the early 2000s. In 2014, after he occupied Crimea, he then guaranteed the rest of the borders of Ukraine as whole and integral, and at various different points, he has also guaranteed the various lines of control, or the lines of peace, depending on which you would consider it, inside Ukraine. So he's consistently guaranteed lines that he's then gone back on. So do I think it will last? I have my doubts. Putin is a fundamentally dishonest man who has consistently violated every peace agreement that has been come to. But do I think it's up to me to determine that? No, I think it's up to the president.
No, absolutely. It's just a conversation, and it's for no one to sort of determine that, except ideally Ukraine. But unfortunately, that decision perhaps is being taken elsewhere, for right or for wrong. But do you realistically, as a military person, believe that Russia is truly on its knees militarily at this stage? Because the counter argument is that Russia can sustain operations longer than Ukraine can at this stage, even with European assistance.
Well, just look at the numbers. I mean, look at the numbers of tanks. They were roughly 7,000 tanks in the Russian armory. There are now fewer than 3,000. Now, given that 4,000 is not just the destruction of their tanks, it's their destruction of all their modern tanks. So they are quite literally now rolling out tanks from museums that were last in action against Germany in 1945. This is quite extraordinary. We are seeing a museum going to war, not an army. The Russians have run out of so much capability, and they are really struggling. What we're seeing is not Russia the great. We're seeing Russia the broken, destroyed by Putin. It should be a great country. It's being destroyed by Putin from being what it should be, a proud partner of Europe, into becoming a vassal of China. That's Putin's choice. That's what he wants.
How would you respond? And here's a final question. That, you know, you, along with so many others in Europe, are playing a dangerous game of brinkmanship. You're pushing Putin to a point because you believe that he is going to be defeated, or he's going to be in a position where he says he doesn't want to fight any longer. There are those who say that, you know, how can Europe afford to take that risk? This is a very large military power. It's a nuclear power. It's been unpredictable. No one can really read Putin's mind. Is Europe willing to take that risk? It's a huge one.
So you asked me if I'm willing to take a risk. Let me just tell you what Putin has done to Europe in the last 20 years. In 2007, Russian forces, under the instruction of President Putin, crossed the border into Estonia, captured two customs officers, and are still holding them in Moscow. One of them has died in prison. In 2008, they invaded and occupied Georgia, holding now South Ossetia and Abkhazia. In 2010, he attempted to murder, and then later did murder, Litvinenko, a Russian dissident, using a nuclear chemical on the streets of London that meant that an entire aircraft had to be taken out of service and industrial cleaning of a hotel had to be conducted because it would have poisoned and possibly killed people who were working in that hotel, no doubt many people from around the world. In 2000, only a few years later, in 2018, Russia used a chemical, Novichok, in Salisbury that failed to kill the two dissidents but then did murder a British woman, Dawn Sturgis. Had that chemical got into the water supply, into a river, it could easily have killed thousands, possibly tens of thousands of people. We are dealing here with a rogue regime, a regime that has already tried to assassinate the Prime Minister of Montenegro, that has blown up factories in Czech Republic, that has attempted to sabotage places inside the United Kingdom. This is not a regime that we are doing anything other than confronting because it has challenged us. Putin is trying to sow death and destruction in Europe. He is threatening the United Kingdom. He has made himself an enemy, and we are trying to protect ourselves and stand with others who are protecting themselves. You would expect nothing less, and we would stand with India on exactly the same basis.